Hello, and welcome to episode number 57 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. Near the middle part of the 20th century, American society became obsessed with a newfangled fascination. This pastime that took the public's imagination by storm prompted serious and excited discussion around interplanetary visitors. The dawning of this new era in public life was fueled by a series of sightings of what quickly became known as flying saucers. More generally, the term adopted was that of UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This term described what was commonly assumed to be sophisticated technological spacecraft being piloted by alien others, Martians or Venusians or something in that line of thinking, our neighbors from the surrounding planets of our solar system. Now, while the public's interest was peaking, the mainstream scientific establishment was much more cautious. All of this hoopla seemed too good to be true, too much like a radio drama depicting an H.G. Wells story or something along those lines. For that reason, mainstream scientists largely steered clear of this topic. And of course, this bias was helped in large measure by what we understand now to be a dedicated disinformation campaign meant to quell public and academic interest being perpetuated by the federal government. However, that said, there were scientists who had not forgotten that their role was to investigate anything mysterious that seemed to be manifesting without assuming a priori that such things simply couldn't be. These rare pioneers of inquiry are the kinds of people determined to let data, not pre-existing bias, lead the way. One such pioneer was and is a scientist named Jacques Vallée, a living legend who has arguably done more for the field of ufology than any other person in the history of the world. What's made Vallée so well regarded over time is that looking back, he was always willing to go again where the data led him, letting it, rather than the common sense thinking of the day, lead to the postulating of new hypotheses. Now, speaking of that, one such data-driven shift that happened for Vallée came when he recognized that, number one, these supposed encounters with alien beings flying sophisticated spacecraft seem to regularly include elements of high strangeness, more akin to what are commonly referred to as paranormal encounters. And number two, that when examined in close detail, these elements overlapped considerably with apparently religious or fairy tale encounters from distant human history. This inspired Vallée to do a deep dive comparing modern-day UFO encounters with events from distant human lore, leading eventually to his controversial, consequential, and groundbreaking book, Passport to Magonia, From Folklore to Flying Saucers. And it is the surprising and provocative revelations uncovered in that seminal book that are the topic of this, the 57th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. I would like to begin this week's podcast by reminding all of us that the hypotheses put forward to make sense of data arising in what we call the UFO phenomenon is always embedded within a context, a social context, which even determines what options are on the table. And because these hypotheses are often generated from within a cultural context, it's always important to be aware of confirmation bias, the possibility that we're merely finding examples that support a particular hypothesis, because that's exactly what we're looking for, and perhaps without being fully conscious of it, we are ignoring other aspects of the data that might lead us to different conclusions. Now, Jacques Vallée, the author of the book we're going to discuss today, is a shining example of being aware of this kind of confirmation bias, being on the lookout for it. And to his credit, when Vallée came across data that seemed to suggest that perhaps the extraterrestrial hypothesis, as it's often proposed, is not the best fit for all of the data, especially once you stretch back beyond a certain period of time in human history. Again, the impetus for this book was not some far-out notion that Vallée chose to pursue. Rather, he simply saw something in the data that suggested a connection, bridging two swaths of data that are often considered as completely distinct. And that investigation of the data, pursuing it wherever it took him, resulted in this book, Passport to Magonia, From Folklore to Flying Saucers. And speaking of that book, this is the description of the book provided by the publisher. Quote, "It is readily acknowledged that our time has surpassed all epochs in history for the accumulation of technical knowledge, physical power over our environment, and economic might. It is less often pointed out, however, that our age has generated and continues to generate mythical material almost unparalleled in quantity and quality in the rich records of human imagination. More precisely, people have very frequently reported the observation of wonderful aerial objects, variously designated as flying saucers, unidentified flying objects, and so on. Among these narratives, descriptions of landings made by these craft are commonplace, and that quite a few accounts purport to inform us of the physical characteristics, the psychological behavior, and the motivation of their occupants. But investigators have neglected to recognize one important perspective of the phenomenon, the fact that beliefs identical to those held today have recurred throughout recorded history and under forms best adapted to the believer's country, race, and social regime. If we take a wide sample of this historical material, we find that it is organized around one central theme: visitation by an aerial people from one or more remote legendary countries. The names and attributes vary, but the main idea clearly does not. Magonia, heaven, hell, elfland, all such places have in common one characteristic: we are unable to reach them alive except on very special occasions. Emissaries from these supernatural abodes come to Earth, sometimes under human form and sometimes as monsters. They perform wonders, they serve man or fight him. They influence civilizations through mystical revelation. They seduce Earth women, and the few heroes who dare seek their friendship find the girls from Elfland endowed with desires and betray a carnal rather than purely aerial nature." These matters are the subject of Passport to Magonia, Jacques Vallée's seminal masterwork that changed our understanding of the UFO phenomenon. An instant classic when first published in 1969, the book remains a must-have resource for anybody interested in the topic of UFOs and alien contact, as well as those fascinated by fairy folklore and other paranormal encounters. Unquote. So that gives you a sense of what this book is about, the approach that it's taking, the historical material it's trying to take into account. But before we get more into the book, let's discuss Jacques Vallée's history. What got him to this place to begin with? Remember, people like Jacques Vallée, along with his associate and colleague J. Allen Hynek, were once proponents of the ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But you have to also remember that these two men, probably more than anyone, were involved with on-the-ground investigations. When a sighting would happen, they would fly to the area, look for soil samples, look for clear manifestations in the consensus reality suggesting that something actually happened, but they would also interview witnesses, determine their credibility, determine their potential history for mental illness, etc. And what they found time and time again was a high degree of high strangeness. Elements of what we might call paranormality co-arose with sightings of UFOs time and time and time again. And it was this clear indication in the data, and regularly attested to in the data, that ultimately led both men, Vallée and Hynek, away from the extraterrestrial hypothesis. In addition, Vallée is also famous for saying that he thinks the idea that these are just beings coming from other planets is not an interesting enough idea. He prefers something more exotic. And it certainly seems to be the case that that's exactly what he found in the data. Again, in the data, not only did he find elements of high strangeness, but he found a striking parallel between the kinds of high strangeness depicted in modern-day UFO encounters and ancient fairy lore. And it's that overlap that led to the investigation that ultimately culminated in this book, Passport to Magonia. All right, let's jump into some quotes from the book. First of all, I want to remind you of Kenneth Arnold, This was the man who in 1947 spotted saucers flying in formation, and it was that sighting that brought about the notion of flying saucers in American culture, or so we thought anyway. Because in this book, there's a section called Sorcerers from the Clouds that talks about this term being used previous to this time period. Quoting from the book, quote, "It is common belief that the term flying saucer was made in America. Was it not coined by an American businessman in 1947? Was not the first official investigation of the mystery by military authorities started in the United States a few weeks later? Well, yes, but a farmer from Texas described a dark flying object as a large saucer as early as January 1878. And ancient Japanese records inform us that on October 27th, 1180, an unusual luminous object described as an earthenware vessel flew from a mountain in the Kii province beyond the northeast mountain of Fukuhara at midnight. After a while, the object changed its course and was lost to sight at the southern horizon, leaving a luminous trail." Unquote. So here we have accounts from before 1947, first the 1878 account in Texas, and then an account from 1180, much more distant history, describing an earthenware vessel, which when you think about it, that's basically describing the same thing. So for those who want to believe that flying saucers, the notion of UFOs, is a relatively new phenomenon born in the 20th century, these kinds of accounts really bring that conclusion into question. And that's what you find in this book time and time again, with a great degree of detail. Every time you want to conclude that a certain phenomena arose in a certain period in human history, you are confronted when you actually pay attention to the historical data that very similar accounts go back further and further and further in human history. And that leads you to the inevitable question, what does it mean if these events have been happening and these seemingly otherworldly beings have been interacting with us for as long as we've been around, basically, for as long as we've been recording events in our history? There seems to be very similar accounts taking place. What are we to conclude from that understanding, that revelation? That's what this book makes us wrestle with. And I really do believe that's the right word to use, wrestle, because Valet is not in the business of providing hard conclusions. He's jokingly said that he's the only ufologist in the world who doesn't know what's going on. Of course, that's ironic because he has more knowledge of the data than probably anyone else and has been studying it for as long or longer than everyone else. But moving beyond that, this notion of Magonia in the title, Passport to Magonia, what is that about? This is what we can say of the Magonian myth. Quote, "According to the treatise arguing against weather magic, Magonia is the name of the cloud realm whence felonious aerial sailors were said to have come. The inhabitants of this realm were said to travel the clouds in ships and worked with Frankish tempestari, tempest raisers, or weather magi, to steal grain from the fields during magically raised storms." In his writings against these popular superstitions, Agobard denounced the belief in witchcraft and the ascription of tempests to magic. Unquote. So as you can see, to the bishops of the day, to the church who basically ran society at that time, Magonia was considered a mythic place, a not real place, a superstitious notion that shouldn't be paid any attention to. But what Valet is doing is saying that much of the mythology is very similar to that which also includes UFOs and alien beings, because the kinds of things that the alien beings do, the kinds of interactions that even modern people have with these supposed alien others, is very similar to the kinds of accounts reported in these interactions with these aerial sailors of the distant past. Now, at the beginning of the podcast, you'll recall that I said that one of the elements that made Valet, as well as people like Hynek, question the notion of the extraterrestrial hypothesis as being sufficient to explain what was going on was the degree of high strangeness, and not to mention seeming absurdity. Now, what kind of high strangeness are we talking about? Well, this is a case in point, I'm now quoting from the book regarding the Eagle River case. Quote, the time was approximately 11 a.m. on April 18, 1961, when Joe Simonton was attracted outside by a peculiar noise similar to knobbly tires on wet pavement. Stepping into his yard, he faced a silvery saucer-shaped object brighter than chrome, which appeared to be hovering close to the ground without actually touching it. The object was about 12 feet high and 30 feet in diameter. A hatch opened about 5 feet from the ground, and Simonton saw three men inside the machine. One of them was dressed in a black two-piece suit. The occupants were about 5 feet in height. Smooth-shaven, they appeared to resemble Italians. They had dark hair and skin and wore outfits with turtleneck tops and knit helmets. One of the men held up a jug, apparently made of the same material as the saucer. His motions to Joe Simonton seemed to indicate that he needed water. Simonton took the jug, went inside the house, and filled it. As he returned, he saw that one of the men inside the saucer was frying food on a flameless grill of some sort. The interior of the ship was black, the color of wrought iron. Simonton, who could see several instrument panels, heard a slow whining sound similar to the hum of a generator. When he made a motion indicating he was interested in the food that was being prepared, one of the men, who was dressed in black but with a narrow red trim along the trousers, handed him three cookies, about 3 inches in diameter and perforated with small holes. The whole affair had lasted about 5 minutes. Finally, the man closest to the witness attached a kind of belt to a hook in his clothing and closed the hatch in such a way that Simonton could scarcely detect its outline. Then the object rose about 20 feet from the ground before taking off straight south, causing a blast of air that bowed some nearby pine trees. Unquote. Now, reflecting on that account, I'm sure you'll acknowledge that the notion of alien beings arriving in a flying saucer but then cooking pancakes certainly flies in the face of what we would expect from such visitors. This is what Vallée has to say about the way human beings tend to draw too quick a conclusion regarding these kinds of events. Quote, the Eagle River case has never been solved. The Air Force believes that Joe Simonton, who lived alone, had a sudden dream while he was awake and inserted his dream into the continuum of events around him of which he was conscious. I understand several psychologists in Dayton, Ohio, are quite satisfied with this explanation, and so are most serious amateur ufologists. Alas, ufology, like psychology, has become such a narrow field of specialization that the experts have no time left for general culture. They are so busy rationalizing the dreams of other people that they themselves do not dream anymore, nor do they read fairy tales. If they did, they would perhaps take a much closer look at Joe Simonton and his pancakes. They would know about the gentry and the food from fairyland. Unquote. Now, as it turns out, this case became even more bizarre and interesting once the authorities actually had these pancakes examined. This is what the book says about that. Quote, it was an unusual day for the Food and Drug Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare when the Air Force requested an analysis of a piece of wheat cake that had been cooked aboard a flying saucer. The human being who had obtained the cake was Joe Simonton, a 60-year-old chicken farmer who lived alone in a small house in the vicinity of Eagle River, Wisconsin. He was given three cakes, ate one of them, and thought it tasted like cardboard. The Air Force put it more scientifically. The cake was composed of hydrogenated fat, starch, and buckwheat hulls, soybean hulls, wheat bran. Bacteria and radiation readings were normal for this material. Chemical, infrared, and other destructive type tests were run on the material. The Food and Drug Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare concluded that the material was an ordinary piece of pancake of terrestrial origin. Unquote. Now, from Vallée's perspective, it is very interesting that there was this exchange of food, a request for water, and an exchange something provided in return. Of course, this is quite common in descriptions of interactions with the fairy folk, also called the gentry. This is what Vallée has to say. Quote, it is interesting that the analysis performed for the Air Force did not mention the presence of salt in the pancakes given to Simonton. Indeed, Wentz was told by an Irishman who was quite familiar with the gentry that, quote, they never taste anything salt, but eat fresh meat and drink pure water, unquote. Of course, pure water is what the saucer men took from Symington, unquote. Now, it's in this section of the book that Vallée also discusses the biases that exist within ufology. And of course, because it's not a peer-reviewed kind of practice, these kinds of biases often go unchecked. What Vallée found was that not only did ufologists not really try to wrestle with these kinds of cases, but they would actively suppress them or ignore them, focusing rather on nuts and bolts cases that looked like clear examples of technological devices up in the sky, because they wanted to bolster their case with a scientific mainstream. They wanted to be taken seriously. But in the midst of that goal, they would actually suppress, ignore, and dismiss data that didn't fit with the prevailing paradigm. And from Vallée's point of view, this is to skew the data entirely and to perhaps miss the entire point of the data, even when it's staring you in the face. So clearly we have examples in modern day where preferred opinions, preferred hypotheses bring about circumstances where real data, hard data, that is part of the historical record, is suppressed, ignored, and when it can't be ignored, it's often reinterpreted. Interestingly, we have cases of that in history as well. And case in point, I want to read from another section of the book. Quote, one day, among other instances, it chanced at Lyons that three men and a woman were seen descending from these aerial ships. The entire city gathered about them, crying out they were magicians and were sent by Grimaldus, Duke of Beneventum, Charlemagne's enemy, to destroy the French harvests. In vain, the four innocents sought to vindicate themselves by saying that they were their own country folk and had been carried away a short time since by miraculous men who had shown them unheard of marvels and had desired to give them an account of what they had seen. The frenzied populace paid no heed to their defense and were on the point of casting them into the fire when the worthy Agobard, Bishop of Lyons, who having been a monk in that city had acquired considerable authority there, came running at the noise, and having heard the accusations of the people and the defense of the accused, gravely pronounced that both one and the other were false, that it was not true that these men had fallen from the sky, and that what they said they had seen there was impossible. The people believed what their good father Agobard said rather than their own eyes, were pacified, set at liberty the four ambassadors of the Sylphs, and received with wonder the book which Agobald wrote to confirm the judgment which had been pronounced. Thus the testimony of these four witnesses was rendered vain. Unquote. So this is the same man, Agobard, that was talking before about Magonia. Now, what's interesting here is not only do the four witnesses who descend from a ship in the sky end up being freed, even though the town folk want to basically burn them at the stake, but this Agobard figure has such authority in that area at that time that when he tells them they're both wrong, that this couldn't possibly have happened at all, they believe him. This is what's so bizarre about prevailing paradigms and how they shape belief. And Vallée's point is we should be just as wary of that today as we are in examples like this from the depth of human history. So far we've included a few cases from fairy lore and how they overlap with modern day UFO phenomenon cases, how much overlap of elements there are, both in terms of the high strangeness and the sheer absurdity that seems prevalent in these kinds of cases. Beyond the fairy lore, there's also cases in religious history that bear a remarkable resemblance with data coming from the UFO phenomenon. And in fact, these cases are so similar from Jacques Vallée's point of view that it really comes down to the interpretive grid. Of course, we know about Fatima, what happened in Portugal in 1917. We discussed that on a podcast in the past. Now, in that case, you had clear evidence of standard UFOs being sighted in the sky beforehand, and then eventually the appearance of a humanoid female figure, which the locals, being of a Catholic worldview for the most part, along with the Catholic Church, officially decided that this was actually a manifestation of the Virgin Mary. Now again, Vallée and other ufologists really question this, because again, not only were there sightings of UFOs leading up to this account, but all of the high strangeness, all of the paranormality, all of the absurdity was also on display. And so really, when you think about it, the main reason the Catholic Church had reason to declare this a religious event was that the people interpreted it that way, which of course is the very definition of confirmation bias. Now, interestingly, Fatima is not the only case like that. And in this book, Vallée also draws attention to other religious events or events that were interpreted as religious. Quoting from the book again, quote, "On noon in September 1702, the sun took on a bloody color several days in succession and cotton-like threads fell down, apparently falling from the sun itself, phenomena reminiscent of the 1917 observations in Fatima, Portugal," unquote. And in a separate case now, quote, "Chaos spread all over Japan on January 2nd, 1749, when three round objects like the moon appeared and were seen for 4 days. Such a state of social unrest developed and seemed so clearly linked with the mysterious celestial objects that the government decided to act. Riot participants were executed, but confusion became total when people observed three moons aligned in the sky, and several days later, two suns," unquote. So that's two different cases. When we think about Portugal, Fatima, that was interpreted as a Catholic event. In Japan, because they have a different sociological history, it was interpreted differently, but it still seemed to be a sign from the heavens declaring that what they were doing on the ground in their society was wrong. Again, when you step back and take more of the 30,000-foot view, what you realize is that we have phenomena manifesting that are highly strange, that sometimes involve what look like meteorological effects in the sky, atmospheric effects, as well as classical UFOs, and the strange manifestations of beings. And of course, often absurdity is in the mix as well. But how these events are interpreted depends on the cultural context of the time and of the place. Now, as you're perhaps beginning to see, in this book, Vallée gives case after case after case stretching across the entire span of human history, or at least recorded human history, showing how often these kinds of cases have happened. And even within American history, prior to the 20th century, we still have shocking events that have been recorded. And now I want to recount one involving Alexander Hamilton, believe it or not. This is what the book has to say. Quote, "In an affidavit quoted in several recent UFO books and journals, Hamilton states that he was awakened by a noise among the cattle and went out with two other men. He then saw an airship descend gently toward the ground and hover within 50 yards of it. It consisted of a great cigar-shaped portion, possibly 300 feet long, with a carriage underneath. The carriage was made of glass or some other transparent substance, alternating with a narrow strip of some material. It was brilliantly lighted within, and everything was plainly visible. It was occupied by six of the strangest beings I ever saw. They were jabbering together, but we could not understand a word they said. Upon seeing the witnesses, the pilots of the strange ship turned on some unknown power, and the ship rose about 300 feet above them. It seemed to pause and hover directly over a two-year-old heifer, which was bawling and jumping, apparently fast in the fence. Going to her, we found a cable about a half inch in thickness made of some red material, fastened in a slip knot around her neck, one end passing up to the vessel, and the heifer tangled in the wire fence. We tried to get it off, but could not, so we cut the wire loose and stood in amazement to see the ship, heifer and all, rise slowly, disappearing in the northwest. Hamilton was so frightened he could not sleep that night. Rising early Tuesday, I started out by horse, hoping to find some trace of my cow," he said. "This I failed to do, but coming back in the evening, found the Link Thomas, about 3 or 4 miles west of Leroy, had found the hide, legs, and head in his field that day. He, thinking someone had butchered a stolen beast, had brought the hide to town for identification, but was greatly mystified in not being able to find any tracks in the soft ground. After identifying the hide by my brand, I went home. But every time I would drop to sleep, I would see the cursed thing with its big lights and hideous people. I don't know whether they were devils or angels or what, but we all saw them, and my whole family saw the ship, and I don't want any more to do with them. unquote. Now, not only is this a case of the UFO phenomenon going back well before the 20th century, but of course, very interestingly and somewhat disturbingly, this is also very similar to cases of cattle mutilation that are so well attested in the 20th and 21st century. And again, speaking of the 20th and 21st century, Vallée is quick to point out his frustration with ufologists who want to ignore cases, reject cases, consider not relevant cases that happened before a certain time period merely for the arbitrary reason that they believe that wouldn't be indicative of an alien invasion, which they think should be the prevailing narrative. Quoting from the book again, Vallée says, quote, "Today there are still students of the phenomenon who reject the notion that the UFO phenomenon was reported before 1947, unquote. And elsewhere he says, quote, "One prominent writer would allow old cases dating back some 200 years, but not before, because a long-term alien presence would negate the newest belief in an imminent extraterrestrial invasion manifested through abductions aboard flying craft," unquote. So again, with all of this in mind, considering all of these historical cases stretching over the course of recorded human history, what are we to make of this entire phenomenon? Do we really consider these separate phenomena, distinct and connected to different kinds of origins? Or are these examples of the same phenomena over time? And if that's the case, what does that do for our convenient explanation that these are sophisticated technological vehicles being flown by aliens from exoplanets and such? Again, when you consider the full breadth of the historical data, you could argue, as does Vallée, that perhaps the ET hypothesis, the notion that these are aliens piloting spacecraft from some exoplanet here to perhaps invade, is merely the latest sociological interpretation of the same event that led one group of human beings to determine this was a religious event, another to interpret this as a fairy event, etc. That perhaps once we separate the phenomena, the actual observations of what happened, from the interpretations of what that meant, what we may be seeing is some kind of intelligence manifesting phenomena in our consensus reality over the entire course of human history. At least that's a possibility we need to consider. This is what Vallée has to say in reflection. Quote, "Let us come to the point now. It would be nice to hold on to the common belief that the UFOs are craft from a superior space civilization, because this is a hypothesis science fiction has made widely acceptable, and because we are not altogether unprepared, scientifically and even perhaps militarily, to deal with such visitors. Unfortunately, however, the theory that flying saucers are material objects from outer space manned by a race originating on some other planet is not a complete answer. However strong the current belief in saucers from space, it cannot be stronger than the Celtic faith in the elves and the fairies, or the medieval belief in Lutens, or the fear throughout the Christian lands in the first centuries of our era of demons and satyrs and fauns. Certainly it cannot be stronger than the faith that inspired the writers of the Bible, a faith rooted in daily experiences with angelic visitation," unquote. Now, as we come to a close of this week's podcast, I'd just like to point out that this book, this excellent book, this groundbreaking book by Jacques Vallée, Passport to Magonia, takes us in a new direction, considering this phenomena beyond the confines of space aliens and sophisticated technology. Now, this is an aspect of the UFO phenomenon data that I want to pursue more, and it's related to discussions I've had recently on Twitter, dropping breadcrumbs, if you will, hinting at some greater understanding that is slowly emerging, at least in regards to some elements of the UFO phenomenon data. We'll continue to pursue that over the next few weeks, so I hope you'll tune in next time as we continue this new aspect of the discussion. Before we sign off, I'd also like to point out that come Monday, there will be a new edition of Liminal Frames, the second episode recorded by myself and Nathan, also known as A Waif Soul on Twitter. So I hope you'll also tune in for that. Again, for those of you interested, if you're listening on YouTube to this podcast, you'll be able to access it right there. It'll be published to my YouTube channel, Exoacademian. And if you're listening on a podcast platform, then you'll want to subscribe to Liminal Frames, which is its own dedicated podcast. Liminal Frames, frames spelt with a PH. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.